You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Your Making It Worse. We're here, we're queer, who cares? I'm Elliot Glazer.
And I'm Brent Sullivan.
And I'm H. Allen Scott. Textual healing.
So, Twitch.
Ooh, I got one.
Which is, it's a live streaming platform that I roundly ignore, has a hate problem. This week, the company filed a suit against two users for conducting, quote, hate raids against Black and LGBTQ streamers in August of this year. The defendants deployed bots to flood the streaming channels of marginalized creators with racist and homophobic content, including slurs and graphic depictions of violence.
We should say too that the live streaming, but like I think it's mostly for live streaming games.
Yeah, during the pandemic, it kind of morphed. It is mainly games. It is definitely mainly games, and it started as games, but it kind of has morphed into a lot of different things, reaction stuff, just because people were stuck at home and they needed a better place, and Twitch is a great place to live stream.
Because I've watched a couple of, I've watched some videos of one hot guy.
I mean, Elliot, those are different types of videos.
I live streamed my show, the show I did with Alaska.
That was on Twitch.
The Madonna show. Yeah, that was over Twitch. And it gets a lot of views and it's great.
I do not get Twitch. I don't get it. I have a couple guys I have crushes on, so I'll watch them. And it's just, I mean, obviously I'm not
what are they doing?
Video games.
Are they video
gaming? They're just, you know, usually you can see their face. So you're like, all right, I guess that's my motivation. And then they're just like playing some dumbass game. I swear to God, like games are always boring to watch now.
I just don't understand. I know this makes me sound archaic, but I do not for the life of me understand the appeal of watching other people play video games. Am I crazy?
I think it's the same as, a little bit.
I think
it's the same as like reaction videos. I mean, maybe that's also something you're not into, but like reaction videos on YouTube are like, you know, pop up. Even the best week ever was essentially early Twitch in that it's just somebody reacting to something or doing something and you're watching their either audible or visual reaction. So it's the same on a lot of different levels.
Maybe you're getting like tidbits of like how to play the game better or something. I don't know. So anyway, so the hate raids described in the suit misused the site's raid tool, when someone closes their channel, when their stream ends, they will allow that person to send all of the people watching their channel to another channel, perhaps someone without as many followers or that kind of thing. That's called a raid. And it's been used increasingly, however, to flood the streams of marginalized creators with trolls and bot accounts hurling abusive insults.
What a waste of a function.
I mean, and it's also, I mean, I was going to say, so that's basically the crux of the article. Twitch promised updates to safety features, including improved banned word detectors and ways to pinpoint channels that are evading bans. I do find it always fascinating whenever there's a problem with one of these social media companies that could perhaps, where the remedy impacts their bottom line, you will always see their, they just throw their hands in the air. They're like, we don't know what to do.
Right.
We have no idea what to do. It's like, well, you created this totally
you're
novel.
You're a corporation.
You have a lot of people employed.
You're a tech company. Put out some HTML code and call it a day.
You know, or like, I mean, discontinue raids until you can get this shit under control. But like,
well, that would affect the bottom dollar because
that's
it keeps people watching.
They don't want people to leave when someone, you know, it's like eyeballs is currency for them. So
it's like with Instagram and like all the shit that comes with Instagram. I mean, these companies are a lot like these sort of the big sort of corporate conservative companies that we rail against in that they, if it affects the bottom dollar, they're not, they don't care what it does to marginalized people. It's just sort of, and that's been the case for companies even before tech was a thing. Like it's just, if the little guy's getting hurt, doesn't really matter because it's all about the big guy.
Yeah. Also, no, it's very naive of me, but I'm like, bummed whenever we talk about something like this, or we talk about like anti-LGBTQ, anti-minority stuff on TikTok or whatever, because I'm like, I thought all the children were like, I just so naively thought
but
like
it's not ran by children,
right?
It's ran by adults, ran by straight white men,
right. But I guess I just hoped that like, I always hope that like the younger generation is as, you know, compassionate as they seem to be, even if it like borders on parody. But hopefully you're right. Hopefully this is just like shitty
and
adult
also,
men.
Hopefully it leads to, you know, the generation now, really the generation below us, will then go on to like lead tech companies or create something amazing and then create it to be inclusive, of everybody and have that in mind when they're creating. Jack Dorsey didn't have that in mind when he created Twitter,
right.
Or Mark Zuckerberg didn't have that in mind when he created Facebook. Like it didn't, in fact, when he created Facebook, it was about sort of like stealing people's photos and putting them on the internet for people to laugh at. Like that's literally what Facebook started as.
What do you
and
mean?
It's
stealing people's
as the dating thing, as like the rating the hot girls
at
Harvard and shit. And it like commenting on people who are hot or not.
Oh, wow.
You know that thing. Mm. And that's how all of that started, was by poking fun of other people who aren't him.
I remember
And it's just it blows me away, like even now with like, you know, the demonetization of on YouTube of like if you use the word queer or if you use the, you know, whatever those sort of things are, these companies will not consider that. And also they're based in San Francisco, which is also the most wild thing to
That's
me,
insane.
The most inclusive city in the city, in the country.
I think it's the fag capital of the world, I'm pretty sure. Right?
It is the fag capital of the world. I mean, there are so many layers to it that it just goes to show you can't speak in sort of the terms of like, well, young people are all liberal, or it's all middle America's problem, or it's, you know, because it is a problem of the coast too. There's a liberal problem with this right now.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating, but it's upsetting.
Well, the good news is that a bunch of these creators organized something called hashtag a day off Twitch, which for Brent is every day.
That's right.
Not even joking.
We are here with actress, writer, producer, activist, student of many things, Shakina Nafak. Hi, Shakina.
Hi.
How are you? Thanks for doing the podcast.
I'm great. Thanks for having me, guys. So much fun to be with you.
Yeah, you're such a special. You're such a. You do so much, and you've done so much in your young life. It's even just like. I mean, I've known you before this, but even in like doing a little bit of research, I'm like, God, she's done so much. It's fucking crazy.
I'm kind of relentless. I think it's because I was a high school dropout and I had a lot to prove. So
right.
I just like, I had to like keep going after that.
Drew Barrymore has that too, actually. I was just watching a video of her talking about that, how she dropped out of school and she felt like because she wasn't getting education, she just started reading and learning everything she could because she wanted to compensate.
Yeah.
I think Drew Barrymore and I are actually a lot alike.
Yeah, you should be on the Drew Barrymore show.
I think that I should be. Yeah.
But you know, the crazy thing is I do a lot of reading and learning, but I can't retain shit anymore.
Really?
All I do is read Wikipedia all day. That's right.
That's the weed.
Thank you, Can. No, that all I do is read Wikipedia all day. And I like, if you quiz me at the end of the day, I'd be like, I have no idea what I read about.
Well,
all day.
I think it's because of the way Wikipedia is. That's not don't think that's a place you want to learn very much. Just get quick facts and tell
Excuse
your text to your friends.
Excuse me.
I'm just saying, maybe read a book.
All right. Okay, back to Shakina.
back to Shakina, me, guys.
By the way, Shakina has an MFA and a PhD, so
I do.
She obviously retains a lot.
Yeah,
I was so excited when you were coming on the show, when I heard you were coming, because I loved you. I mean, I think how most people probably know of you is because of your amazing turn in the final season of Transparent. You were incredible in that. You were such a, I mean, I'm not like one of those, like, you know, rocks chakra like person, but you were such like an energy. You had such an energy in that last season, and that last season was so hit with so much drama,
yeah,
that you coming in with this sort of like force of just love. It was just a beautiful performance, and it was a great, great, great part of the last season.
Thank you. I really thought you were going to say that most people know me from Difficult People, where I was just a bitchy trans truther. So which is also true.
That too.
But but yeah, you know, with Transparent, I just was like, I knew that I was coming into that situation, and so I just felt like I had to bring that peaceful healing. Mm-hmm. From the moment I started working with everybody, like, it wasn't just, you know, in front of the camera. I was really doing what I could to just embody that in the space, yeah, and transform the energy, you know, so that we could have a celebratory finale.
Yeah.
How do you do that? I mean, like, you seem like such, you are obviously such a spiritual person. You were raised Jewish and went to Catholic school. Is that right?
Yeah, that happened.
Wow. And now you're interfaith, right?
Yeah. I'm like a Jewish Buddhist Christian.
Oh my God. Oh, I love that.
Three out of the four so far.
Yeah. You were both baptized, and you had a bar mitzvah.
I did.
It's fucking wild.
Wow. Incredible.
How much does spirituality like impact your day to day life? And like, I wonder how much of it is like traditional religion.
You know, it actually, there's like a substantial component of it that's traditional religion, but it's not like conventional traditional religion. Like, I'm really interested in like the practices that have been handed down from generation to generation, and mm-hmm, I think there's a lot of power in those rituals, so I enjoy participating in them, like church or synagogue. And actually, this is so wild, but on Erev Yom Kippur, the like night mm-hmm before Yom Kippur, my chiropractor invited me to try tefillin on, which was like the first time I had done that as like a trans woman. You know, I think one time I got like roped into the mitzvah van, somewhere, you know, when I was like young. But but he just felt really strongly that like it was something that I deserved to do, and I should have the right to do. And it was really special to like sit in my chiropractor's office and like read these prayers that I knew from my childhood, like wrapped in this leather, you know, prayer thing. Mm-hmm. And
which is such a Jewish thing too, to do it in your chiropractor's office.
Yeah, yeah,
like that. I know. Doctor, you know? Yeah,
like, it's like either your therapist or your chiropractor. It's one of the two.
Totally. Yeah.
Can
so
you explain what it is for our listeners and for Brent?
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Yeah. So like one of the holiest prayers of the Jewish tradition, the Ve'ahavta, thou shalt love, mm-hmm, it says that you should bind the words of God as a sign like on your forehead, and I guess it upon your heart. And mm-hmm, and so there's these like two boxes that contain prayers in them, and they have leather straps, and you literally wrap one around your forehead, and you have this box with a prayer on it on your forehead, and you have another one right on the side of your arm, like in sort of your armpit next to your heart. And you pray these prayers, and you wrap this tefillin. And I'm pretty sure it's reserved for men only.
Yeah.
And so I was like, when my chiropractor first asked me like if I had worn them before, I was like, are you transphobic, dude? Like, what's the problem here?
Right.
And he was like, no, you have a Jewish soul, you should get to do it. And I was like, okay, that I could get down with. Okay. I think that's the verse.
Okay, gender progressive, yes.
Yeah. But he does not know that I have been baptized and that I go to church regularly. So I'm sure, you know.
Keep that to yourself.
Exactly. You know, you don't need to share everything, you know. Disclosure's a choice.
But that is something that, like, I mean, something you said that like really hits me and has always hit me, because I converted to Judaism. I was raised Mormon and converted to Judaism. And like, part of the thing that really drew me to Judaism was that it is this sort of idea of you can kind of make it your own. And that's what interfaith really means to me too. You can, like, I really embrace the idea of Shabbat in a way, and how Shabbat through community and through the history of Shabbat, it really brings community together more so than just going to sort of, you know, services on Friday nights or on high holidays or whatever. There's something special about Shabbat. So you can really morph it and make it your own. Is that to you what like being interfaith means, really sort of taking on what speaks to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think because we live in this, in a world where there are really present spiritual fields that have been generated by these global practices for millennia, we have all these tools at our fingertips that we just have to learn how to work with and use. And I think that, like, my idea of, like, having a direct relationship to what I consider God to be allows me to translate that relationship into any sort of ritual practice that keeps me engaged and helps me build community and feel connected. And like Elliot was asking about, like, I think that my creative work is really, you know, like, before the pandemic, I was really at a point where I was like, maybe I should just, like, drop out of this whole acting thing and just go to divinity school and become a priestess. Because I, you know, it's like the highs and the lows, you know, you get a job and you're like, I broke through. And then you're like, now I'm unemployed for another 18 months.
Right. I think Shirley MacLaine did that, by the way.
Well, I wouldn't really? Be surprised. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Yeah.
You know, I have a lot in common with Shirley MacLaine. So
that is a huge, huge, huge compliment. Shirley MacLaine is the ultimate.
Of course. I mean, yeah.
I wish I'm these guys and most of our listeners know that I'm a non-believer, although I support those of the Jewish faith and everyone knows that. But sometimes I wish I was into religions because I think being a minister is performative, but also social work, which are both up my alley. And I've always thought it would actually be a great job if I just believed what I was saying.
Yeah, one of the Ivy Leagues, I don't remember which one, but just recently hired the new head of their, like, chaplain program, you know, where they have, like, the rabbi and the minister, and mm-hmm. and they hired an atheist to run that program.
Probably University of Michigan. Yeah.
I think that's what you're thinking. It was definitely like Yale or Harvard or something with, like, a really strong divinity program.
Yeah.
So, and one of my besties is atheist, and we always talk about, like, how, you know, science and faith can coexist in a really wonderful way.
Yeah.
And the whole performative aspect of ministry, I mean, that's what I feel like I kind of had this realization that I was like, oh, well, what I do on stage or in front of the camera or with my writing, like, that is my ministry. Like, that is how I preach. Mm-hmm. And it's not traditional, conventional. Yeah. It's, like, mostly focused on bringing people who felt removed or isolated or you know, excommunicated, whatever that might mean, from their faith systems growing mm-hmm. up as queer people or whatever, to, like, have a kind of access point with something greater than them. And that's what mm-hmm. I just think is so important. Like, I was always like, no offense, Brent, but I was like, I could never fuck an atheist. You know, like, I couldn't, like, give this pussy up to someone who didn't believe in something greater than themselves.
Mm. Yeah.
And, that's just
that needs to be on a shirt, by the way. Don't give this pussy up if you can't believe. That's a good one.
You know, I think the shirt would be, I'd never fuck an atheist. I think that's a really good shirt, actually.
Yeah, that's probably a stronger one. I wanted to ask you about, I mean, the trans experience, I think, is something that I was talking with my boyfriend about this, about how it really is sort of like the defining characteristic of quit bragging. It is the defining characteristic of sort of our time in terms of the civil rights movement that's happening right now. I mean, it is really shaping who we are right now. And one of the things you had said in a quote that, like, you didn't really identify with the club kids and a lot of the things, like, the trans people you were seeing on, like, Maury Povich or Jerry Springer or those kind of places, which really was the commercialized image of transness that we saw in, like, the 90s.
Right.
So, like, when did you feel seen, really?
Well, gosh, you know, I was 18 years old and I was going to college at UC Santa Cruz, and they had this event called the Queer Fashion Show, which was this, like, iconic annual event that unfortunately no longer happens. And I did this performance piece where I was, like, in dominatrix drag, whipping these guys dressed as football players, but with, like, fishnets under their jock straps.
Oh my God.
To the corn.
Exactly, Brent.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
To the corn song Faggot, which was, like, an anthem of my youth. And that's the first time I felt seen. That's when I was like, this is actually who I am. And, like, you know, and people, like, really received it. And I was like, okay, great. Like, all these things working together sort of put out into the world who I am. And, it's not that I didn't identify with the club kids so much as that, like, well, I was young and I was like, how do I get to, I'll never be them. Like, I didn't understand the road from where I was to who they were. And then I didn't have like any sort of, you know, convention. There was no conventional transsexual at the time.
No.
It was not like a, you know, just an easy bake oven version of like what it is to be trans. And there still really isn't. I mean, because the models that we have available to us mostly are still ridiculously inaccessible to most people.
Yeah. That's true.
You know, I hadn't thought about this until just recently, but you know, obviously depictions of LGBT people were problematic at times in the 90s, but I think much like you talked about, and I know you've, Alan, you talked about, and Shakina, you've talked about in interviews where, you know, the depiction of trans people in particular on like talk shows was just like appalling. And of course, you know, in hindsight, you know, you look back 25, 30 years and you're like, it's like, what was that like to see depictions that were so, I mean, what, universally trashy, like, egregiously sexualized. I mean,
freaky.
Just,
it was like a freak. Yeah, it's like a freak show.
Right.
But the Club Kids also embraced that in a way, which felt like they were taking the power back a little bit.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, around the same time, I know that Kate Bornstein was on some of those talk shows. And Kate Bornstein's like an icon, legend, role model of mine.
Great
also,
writer.
Also, an incredible writer, an incredible actor who I've worked with in my play. And she was there taking all those questions in the hot seat from the people who really wanted to treat her like some sort of, you know, freakish object. And she was just, you know, very chill and very grounded in the way that she fielded those questions. And I can look back on that moment in time, and even with today's, like, you know, turf wars and everything, with as much compassion as I can muster on a good day, to understand that if you're not inside this experience, it's got to be weird, you know? Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
You know, most people, I would venture to assume, feel like really cozy with their genitals and their and whatever, and that like makes a lot of sense in connection with their brain and who they are in the world. And so, you know, especially when you get into people who are like who need a medical transition in order to come into their full self, there's a lot of and that strikes terror in the hearts of men. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because it doesn't make sense to y'all that we would go through all this shit, you know? And I don't expect you to get it. But that's also why I create a lot of work that's trying to demystify that, because I don't believe in making it a hush-hush, like we don't talk about that respectability politics thing, because then all those like questions continue to ruminate without answers, and people turn to like fetishism, you know, or make assumptions. And so, you know, everyone has a job in the revolution, and mine is occasionally to talk about my vagina.
Yeah. You know, that's a really like a really brilliant and I think generous thing to say. And that's, I think it's a sentiment that I've sort of articulated maybe off the air with amongst the three of us.
Yeah.
But never, I don't think it's ever been articulated on this podcast before, which is that, you know, which is that, you know, for some people that might be something that takes a minute to understand. And I think obviously people's paths should get to the place of understanding. But yeah, I think you make a lot of sense when you say that. Yeah.
Well, you know, part of what just going back to the topic of like trans issues being the forefront of civil rights, like, first of all, you know, we are building off of these movements that were started by women's suffrage and the disability movement and civil rights and the gay rights movement. So we have a lot of experience to draw from. And we also have members of our community in all those other communities who are teaching us and guiding us along the way. So, you know, we're at the forefront because we've learned a lot, and we're just like the next step. But now I can't remember the other thing I was going to say, but it had something to do with this. Oh, yeah. So one of the things that's like really present in today's like discourse around inclusivity is neurodivergence and learning how to respect and work with folks whose brains work differently than your brain might work. And and so, you know, I think about, like, I like to think about transness in the context of biodiversity, which is sort of like an essential need for the survival of our species and the planet. And and neurodivergence is also part of that. And specifically, you know, we're talking about people who might be like on the autism spectrum or have depression or anxiety, but and other invisible disabilities. But also, when I'm trying to like change hearts and minds around the issue of transness, I have to take a beat to like see if I can just imagine how other people's brains are working.
Right. And that doesn't mean you're not apologizing for anything. All you're doing is trying to consider how they might feel, not because they're in the right, but because you're like, how can I actually connect with them in a way that, even if it doesn't mean you actually change their minds, you can at least hopefully get them to understand you a little bit more. And I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I just, like, that's how I think it's is an interesting way to actually approach this kind of stuff, because it doesn't, it takes people off the defensive, I think, a little bit, and might actually make more impact.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I used to be, and I still consider myself to be very radical. Like, sometimes I'll have a crisis moment when I'm afraid I've lost my edge, and then I remember that I, like, sing about getting gangbanged by Thai strippers. Like, so, like, all right, I'm cool, you know?
Yeah, I can hang,
But, you know, and I think there is, like, obviously, like, I'm all here for the folks in my community who don't have time for that shit. Mm-hmm. But what I'm realizing is, like, maybe I have time for that shit. Like, I think that I've gotten pretty good at having some of those conversations. There are times when it's like, no, I'm not going to deal with J.K. Rowling.
Right,
I'm
of course.
I'm not going to, you know?
No thanks,
But, yeah, I just think, you know, like I said, there's a job for everyone in the revolution. So we need the people who are not going to take shit, and especially, like, on social media, and when it's like the easy and satisfying thing to do is to have a hot take that shuts someone down.
Yeah.
And, yes.
And oh, you know,
guilty of that.
Totally.
It's second nature, which is so kind of gross, but it is. It's just where we go to, especially if we're artists.
But what if your first nature was to be compassionate and patient, you know? And that's where, like, my spiritual practice comes in.
Yeah.
This is such a dumb microcosm version of this, but I think a couple years ago, when, like, the issue with, like, the trans bathroom stuff was happening, I was like, there was an article about some high school kids who were not, I don't know if we talked about it on the podcast, but there were high school kids who were not drinking or eating during the day to avoid going to the bathroom.
Oh, right.
And it, like, that for whatever reason in particular, it, like, destroyed me. Like, that just killed, the thought of that just killed me.
Yeah.
And I posted about it on Instagram, and this buffoon from high school, like, I'm from Long Island, it's like buffoon nation, like, truly, it's like the land of the idiots. But this guy from high school was like, he wrote, like, if he stands to pee, He goes to the boys' room. If he sits, he goes to the girls' room, which is that easy. Like, something so stupid.
By the way, I almost always sit when I pee. I'm just saying that.
Even in public? I won't always. No, in public, I won't.
Not always in public, but at home, no. I like to sit. I like a rest.
Take a break.
Yeah. So I just to say again, this is, like, I'm not trans. It's not my place to, like, tell anybody anything other than to, like, stand up for trans people. But I was like, I mean, in the comments, and I don't usually engage, and this was the first time that I really engaged, where I was like, I tried to talk to him in a way. I mean, I haven't talked to this guy in 20 years, you know, he's just an idiot. But
yeah.
I tried to talk to him about it in, like, in some sort of way that felt like it was connected to him, where I was like, responding to how he speaks.
Because you know where he's from.
I know where he's from. And so we started talking, and he was like, I was like, I'm not trans, but, like, as a gay guy in high school, I remember feeling, you know, this way and this way and this way. And he was, I swear to you, like, he thought, but you were pop. He said, like, but you were popular. And I was like, well, thank you. But also, that doesn't mean that I wasn't suffering secretly. And, like, we started talking, and I don't think it fully changed his mind, but it got to this place where it actually disarmed him, because I made it so that he could understand it instead of trying to slam dunk on him.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which, again, part of me wants to. I want to shut it down.
Oh, the impulse is very strong.
But but I don't think that's always. I think that's harder to make happen when social media only makes us more like bloodthirsty to shut other people down.
Tribal,
it's terrifying.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's so one of the things I think about you that also strikes me. I mean, you are a radical activist in a lot of wonderful ways. And
thanks.
One of the things that I think is so impactful is that early on in I guess your trans journey is that you decided to, by choice, go bald. And that is, I think, I mean, I have a lot of trans friends who talk about that sort of biological response of, you know, whatever gender you're assigned at birth and the things that happen to you through puberty and through getting older or whatever the case may be, and really struggling with that. And we all, I mean, we all struggle, everyone struggles with the changes our bodies go through, but then to add on living the trans experience and dealing with those two different worlds, it's just, it must be mind-blowing. What made you sort of decide to go about being bald and your hair journey?
My hair journey is still ongoing, and I love it. I love that I can be public with it because it's such a big part of my identity and things that I'm still trying to figure out. But I think, you know, there are a couple things that made me want to go bald. One is that ever since I was very young, I always felt that if I had the strength to deal with my personal issues in a public forum, I could help other people who were dealing with the same thing and afraid to speak about them. So I've always tried to challenge my body image issues in the hopes that it would empower other people to challenge theirs. And that's just been like a core value for me. Excuse me. The other thing about the baldness was that ultimately, you know, when I first came out in like 2001 as trans, and like non-binary was not a term that we used then, but gender nonconforming was a term that we used, and some people still do. I like that term. You know, I knew that there were certain changes I had to make with my body in order to feel good in who I was and how I moved through the world. But more so, I have this conviction that like society needs to change the way it works with gender and the way it oppresses people through unrealistic standards of beauty. And so I thought, like, let me just be a little punk rock and assert this, you know, like demand she, her pronouns with my bald head, you know? And and also there are like plenty of other gorgeous, beautiful bald women who are cis, you know, and have different journeys with whether they shave their head or have alopecia or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it just felt like, you know, it felt like I shaved my head. I started shaving my head when I was very young as a sort of reminder that physical form was fleeting.
Yeah.
And it kept me humble, and it was connected to some like ritual dance work that I was studying in school.
I want to know what that is.
Which
too.
Is so Santa Cruz.
Yeah, so Santa Cruz. Yeah, I trained for like a decade with Diego Pinon, who's the founder of Body Ritual Movement, which is like a fusion of Japanese Buto dance and indigenous Mexican ritual and avant-garde bioenergetics, and just is a very like experimental ritual-based physical movement form. That's like really how I managed to kind of heal myself and become the person that I am today through this dance. And one of the, like, my teacher shaves his head. His teacher actually didn't. Well, yeah, one of them did. And it's sort of like part of the legacy of this tradition. And so after my very first weekend workshop with Diego, I shaved my head, and then I kept my head shaved for.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's great. This is also therapeutic for me to hear right now, because I've been convinced I'm going bald the last week.
You're not going bald, Brent. You're not going bald.
You might be going bald.
Thank you. And finding more hairs than usual on the pillowcase. Go ahead, Alan.
I just wanted to, like, the sort of being unapologetic in the thing you said. One of the things I think always, and I agree, I think it's good to lead with empathy, and that, you know, we should be understanding of people's, the mainstream public's understanding of sort of coming to terms with gender and everything that's happening. But at the same time, a lot like with racism, with sexism, with so many things, it's not the person's job.
Exactly.
It's not a trans person's job
that
to
too.
Make you non-transphobic.
Right.
It is
right.
our job as people who are allies of trans, of the trans community or queer community or our Black brothers and sisters or whatever it is our job to then say, no, you're being wrong. And what Elliot did with his friend, I think, is so important, is like, this is why you're approaching this wrong, in my opinion, and I'm going to tell you that.
I always say, in my opinion, too, always.
Yeah, it's not the trans person's job to, or the Black person's job or whatever, to tell the person that they're being wrong. It's just not. So I
right.
be unapologetic is what I say.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I feel like in some ways I've been like a professional transgender person.
Right.
Like that's
right.
like been like part of what I've done for literally decades, y'all.
Right.
Like
it's wild.
So, for a long time. And so you know, I guess like there are times obviously when I'm like really exhausted by, you know, the task of educating people. But
yeah.
on the best days, when I feel like my creative work is doing it in a way that's fun and irreverent and sincere and like spiritually eye-opening, then I'm like, oh, this is great. Like, let me bring people along, you know, because I want to like leave the world a better place than I found it.
Yeah,
but there's definitely times when I just have to retreat and let other people pick up the battle. Yeah. And that's fine too.
Yeah.
And you're definitely accomplishing that. Now, with that said, I did just look up the Wikipedia article for neurodivergence. It was lengthy. I read the whole thing and I already forgot it, but it was brilliant. It was brilliant.
My sister is obsessed with neurodivergence.
Really?
Like, the word comes up constantly. She and her and my brother-in-law like read. There's a book called Neurodivergence.
There's a whole like school of thought and now like a movement. Yeah. You know.
Yes, and it's wow. and it makes so sense. Important. I actually like I get it. I get it. Because it describes people who act. It's so hard to like even describe like what it applies to, but it's just like divergent of anything that's like. I wouldn't even know what the right word is.
Right, like a normative brain function.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, chemical and thought-based. And it's, you know, I mean, neurodivergence, it's like ADHD. It's like fidget spinners. You know,
right.
There's like things, we have like neurodivergent accessibility tools all around us all the time. We just don't understand them as that or call them that. But when we start being a little more mindful about how to... Like, you know, just the idea of being reading and not retaining anything or being like an auditory learner or all these. It's like our brains all work a little differently.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So it's important to understand that people aren't going to come at things the same way that you come at things.
Yeah,
definitely.
So true. Before we go, Brent, did you want to mention? I mean, I know that you faced a Westboro Baptist Church protester.
Oh, the best.
Yeah,
and,
I know,
and Brent
years
is obsessed with, or was obsessed with Fred Phelps.
I used to love Fred Phelps, and it was the pride of my life that I was on their website at one point.
I got protested too at a speech.
Yeah. Were you also a protested, Shekinah?
I've never been like personally protested, but I've like encountered the Westboro Baptist protesters. Like I was at the Supreme Court. Yeah, the Supreme Court protest.
Yeah, yeah. The Title VII hearing.
Yes, exactly. And then there was a bunch of like Westboro Baptist people there with like the God Hates Fag signs. And I just walked by and I was like, you know, Jesus died for all of our sins. And he was like, and I was like,
oh my God.
Sir, is your comeback? Like,
Did
you not read the literature? You know?
Oh my God.
I didn't read that pamphlet.
So well, we couldn't have enough time with you, but what a blast. And you're just such a dynamic person who's just, you know, truly like you're just so
inspirational.
You have so many layers to you. Yeah, you're really inspirational.
Guys, you're so brave.
You're so brave. You're so
God.
Where would you like people to follow you, our listeners? Where would you like them to follow you on?
I'm Shekeenz, Shakeenz on all platforms.
Awesome.
Fantastic.
So, yeah, amazing. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and kind of a TikTok. Whatever.
And maybe Twitch.
Yeah, never.
Twitch
but that's
too.
Okay. Yeah. But thanks, guys. It's been fun chatting.
Thank you so
much.
You.
Sure.
And another thing. I'm so excited to talk about Tammy Faye because of the new movie, The Eyes of Tammy Faye. Now,
which I saw.
Oh, Tammy, but just to give some background on who Tammy Faye Baker was. Well, Tammy Faye Mesner at the end of her life. Tammy Faye Baker and why am I forgetting her husband's name?
Now?
I never cared about him.
Jim Baker.
I never cared about Jim. It was always Tammy Faye. But Jim and Tammy Faye started this sort of Christian television network, the PTL or PTO or whatever, PTL. And it was Christian television, basically. And they created theme parks. And then they had a massive falling out because he abused funds and he would steal people's money and then buy lavish houses and all these crazy things.
Yeah. He was sleeping with people who worked there. He was sleeping with guys.
It was a scandal.
With guys?
Yes.
Yeah, there was. Wow. Yeah, in the suit, there was one where he slept. He was accused of sleeping with one man. Anyway, the new movie sort of follows Tammy Faye's life and how she really was not a liberal icon, but a sort of just an icon of queer people in a lot of ways. And the film is produced by and is based on a documentary by the people who created World of Wonder, who created Drag Race. So it's very much a queer film. The documentary is amazing.
Yeah.
But Tammy Faye was so radical in so many ways. In the 80s, at the height of the AIDS epidemic, she had a man on who had AIDS to talk about his experience. And she very openly said, it's not Christian to not put your arms around someone mm-hmm. who is suffering. That is the Christian way. And she was very radical in that way. And it's kind of mind-blowing how advanced she was for her time.
You know, I just saw a program. My husband and I, Jim, sat the other night and watched a program. And it was so touching about a young man who had AIDS and went home to tell his mom and dad about it and the hurt and everything that happened in the family, which I'm sure, you know, you were very well aware of. Yeah. And when asked what was the saddest thing in his life about the fact that he had AIDS, you know, his own parents were afraid to touch him. His own sister was afraid to touch him. And he said, to think that I might never again have a hug. You know, and how sad that we as Christians, who are to be the salt of the earth, and we who are supposed to be able to love everyone, are afraid so badly of an AIDS patient that we will not go up and put our arm around them and tell them that we care.
Yes, I know, it is tragic, and that's the tragedy
Steve,
of the situation.
I just want to tell you something.
What's that, Tammy?
If there would have been any way, you know, I know you were sick, and that's the only reason we didn't have you come and sit in the studio next to us today, because you have your chemotherapy treatments, and you needed to get home quickly so you wouldn't miss them. But I want to tell you, there's a lot of Christians here who love you and who wouldn't be afraid to put their arm around you and tell you that we love you and that we care.
Thank you, Tammy. God bless you for saying that. I think that's a very, very important thing.
And I don't know if you guys had any, like, in your childhood, did you know who Tammy Faye Baker was? Did she have any influence on you?
I don't. By the way, the reason we're bringing this up is because obviously you probably have seen trailers for it. There's a new movie out that is all about Tammy Faye Baker's life. And yeah. They talk about, like, these two, Alan, you just described the one, these two kind of preeminent moments in which she, you know, despite having a very conservative following in the 80s, you know, stood up for gay people, which I think is really important. You know, I feel like she's one of these people where I knew her face. I remember when that documentary came out. And I was like, yeah, I know that person's face, but I wasn't particularly familiar with her. I, of course, didn't watch their network.
I think she was, I was familiar with her in, they would obviously impersonate her on SNL, which I remember, but yeah. I didn't really connect who she was. I just knew that she was this, like, she was Christian, and then I remember her on SNL or even like Larry King, and I never really stopped and thought about it until I saw the documentary and was like, holy shit, this woman.
Yeah. Well, she had this like when Jim Baker was sent to prison or was sentenced or whatever, just to show you how much of a drag queen she really was, and I interviewed Jessica Chastain about the movie, and I talked to her about sort of the drag element of who Tammy Faye was, and just to like when she's leaving the courthouse and her husband was just sent to prison, she starts singing on the courthouse steps. That's her news conference, is her singing.
Oh my God.
And it's just, she was so extra and like three-dimensional. She just was wild on so many levels that like she lived in this world, in her own little world, and the film does a really good job of sort of showing that like the world that Tammy Faye saw was very different than the world she was living in. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene in the film where she's singing and it's like flags and fireworks and the crowd's going crazy and people are doing crazy things. And in reality, it shows the audience and they're just sitting there quietly, just watching. And it just shows this disconnect that she had, but that disconnect was part of what made her, I think, so special and resonate with so many people who weren't allowed in the audiences she had, because those audiences were mainly white, Christian, straight people who would sit there and sort of, you know, watch this conservative woman sing these Christian songs. But it was queer people at home who were being like, this is a drag queen.
Gay icon?
She is. She
like a deep
fully
cut,
is
gay,
a gay icon.
Deep cut gay
I don't know.
Icon,
if she, I don't think she's that deep cut, though.
She's not deep cut. She's fully a gay icon, I think, in a lot of ways.
Was she ever
impersonated
on Snatch Game on Drag Race?
Yes, yeah, Ginger Minj did her on Drag Race. But she and Sharon Needles had that tattoo of her, on his arm during the show. Yeah, but she did become a gay icon, particularly after the divorce, after she divorced Jim Baker, because she had that talk show with Jim J. Bullock it was queer people who helped her sort of recover in a lot of ways post Jim Baker and post all of that. And she started to realize that it was gay. It was these gay men who sort of fully embraced her and took her on the drag queens and took her on and sort of gave her almost a purpose at the end of her life in a lot of ways. Right. It really was kind of beautiful.
It's wild. I mean, I haven't thought too much about her, but obviously I thought that was an interesting, you know, with the movie out now, it's interesting to think about how she was, I guess. I mean, it's interesting that she was a gay icon even before her like bouncing back, in the sense that she was preaching such, you know, Christian evangelical stuff that ended up being so hypocritical, or maybe not what she was preaching, but the practice of them just being so excessive and the, you know, the amount of money. I mean, it was the money they spent and it was just shit show.
She fully benefited off of like crime.
Yeah, so it's so interesting that she was embraced in like, it feels like she was clearly warm toward the queer community, but it was, she didn't necessarily like, it's layered in the fact that
she was complicit in not only a lot of the wrongdoing, even though she was never legally charged with anything, she was complicit in a lot of the wrong, of sort of turning a blind eye to a lot of the excess. I mean, the fact that she was living sort of a millionaire's life off of church money, that's a little weird. But Jim Baker was the hypocrite, and he continues to be to this day. I mean, he's still alive, he's still a preacher.
He sells like
and
he's holy selling water, some, right?
Yeah, he's he selling sells, some water sells, that cures COVID and AIDS prepper, and everything else.
Doomsday prepper food and holy water.
Oh, wow,
he's on TV doing the same thing he did the first time around, just with some religion. I mean, it's still religious.
No,
I don't understand how people send him money.
I support it. I think people who are that dumb should not have money.
Should not have money.
But
he should. Money, why should he?
Well, I'd rather have it be in the hands of one dumbass than 50,000. So.
What would your aunt say?
Brent, what would your Aunt Ramona say about something she heard today?
I think you're right. You're balding.
She's wrong. You're wrong.
She's really wrong. You're not balding.
My Aunt Joanne would say, my personal anthem is also Faggot by Korn. which I have to look up because I can't believe that that's real.
I know. That was a curveball.
How about Aunt Anne?
I tried taking Tammy Faye's influence on makeup, and Ray didn't touch me for 2 weeks, so I threw that away real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Tammy Faye's makeup is not someone you want to
emulate per se.
No.
Wow.
No.
Well, thanks for listening. I'm Elliot Glazer.
I'm H. Allen Scott.
And I am Brent Balding Sullivan.
Oh, you son of a bitch.